Very nice to have you back on the show. It's been quite some time, actually.
It has. It's so nice to be back. I definitely follow your journeys on social media and am always interested in the things that you have to say about the various topics. My students love your podcast. I'm always learning from the conversations that you have. So it's an honor actually to be back here. Also, like, it's funny how some things change and some things don't. I think last time we talked about agencies and family reunification, and still such a big issue, right?
No, they've all been resolved. Everything's smooth, and all families that want to reunite are in Canada.
If only they put
Yes.
us out of business, right?
Yeah. And then a couple of years after this episode about statelessness, that will be resolved.
Yes.
So.
And so it all starts with your podcast.
Definitely. I think that what is actually it was interesting. I mean, we want to talk about your new book, but it feels kind of timely in a way because we've been talking about notions of sovereignty in a number of different podcasts. Just because, it's something that we talked about in the episode where we were talking about Gaza and the conflict, and it's just something that has been top of mind for me. I've been doing a lot of work in presentations and just conversations about intersections between Indigenous law and Indigenous rights and immigration and that sort of thing. So I was really fascinated by the fact that you've written this book about the notion of statelessness and what does it mean and how is it impacting people, because I do think it's a pretty under I mean you said that it was something that's covered quite a lot, but I mean maybe it's just the first for me, the first body of work that I've read on the subject. So it was very interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that because I do think it is an emerging area that, even some of the key cases that went before the Supreme Court in the last 5 years, I would say some of the applicants were stateless, and yet that was such a little played up fact. It wasn't played up as much as I would have expected or I would have wanted to if I was involved. But I think it's a really interesting concept because we do confront it, and I'm sure both of you have seen it in your own work. Occasionally, and just for listeners who might not know, I just want to start at the beginning. And the term stateless really means a person who doesn't have citizenship to any country whatsoever. So they might have temporary or permanent residence somewhere, but ultimately what it means is that they don't have a home legally in terms of their citizenship. And so there's a lot of repercussions as a result of that, that you might not be able to access certain kinds of services such as education, healthcare, and you might be marginalized as a result because you are constantly trying to resolve your immigration status, and you might not have immigration status in certain periods of your life as a result, which might lead to complications with simple things like getting a cell phone or a bank account, depending on where you are.
Yeah, so there's a, and as you mentioned in your book, there's a difference between being stateless and being without status in a country.
Yes.
So, do you want to go over some of the ways that people can find themselves without having citizenship anywhere?
Yeah, so different countries have different laws with regards to who is eligible to get citizenship. And in Canada, we're quite lucky because we do have birthright citizenship in the sense that anybody born within Canada's borders automatically gets citizenship. Not every country has this same approach. And so you find some countries have approaches where you either obtain citizenship through a parental link. Canada does that as well. But that might be the main mode of acquiring citizenship. Others, long-term residence and other criteria Most countries offer a route of naturalization, which requires people to pass certain tests, like language tests and knowledge tests. We do that too in Canada, and other kinds of criteria, such as a certain period of time of residence. So, you could see all kinds of different rubrics in terms of the ways in which people get citizenship. But because there's different ways in which countries confer citizenship, a lot of people fall through the cracks. And so I, kind of interrogate, what are the moves behind certain legal frameworks that justify when citizenship is conferred. And so it's interesting because I think a lot of people take for granted, especially in Canada, because we have birthright citizenship, that people must be citizens somewhere. But that's not always the case.
Go for it, Deanna.
Sorry. I was fascinated in the way that you describe that in many countries, Canada included, one of the challenges becomes that in order to establish that you are stateless, you have to overcome the hurdle of demonstrating that you're not entitled to citizenship in the place where you might have been born or in the place and the complexities around that. And that's how I've sometimes come across cases involving statelessness, where to me it seems like somebody is de facto stateless. However, the onus of proving that they would not actually get the recognition of citizenship in their country of birth can be very, very challenging. And I'm just I thought it was good how you laid that out very much and the challenges that people face in those circumstances.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I think that's one of the most, I would say, disturbing findings from my research as a legal scholar. And you, as lawyers, will appreciate this, that, we're always held to different burdens and standards of proof when we're presenting evidence before either administrative tribunals or courts. And they're quite strict, even in an administrative setting, we have to follow rules of evidence. Yet what we find is that in cases where stateless persons are involved, in some cases, there's very little to no evidence. And in fact, fact finders are making speculative findings based on a tangential link that someone might have to a foreign country to make a legal finding that they are essentially a citizen of a different country. So I'll give an example, one that many of you and your listeners might be familiar with. So someone might be, putting forth a refugee claim, and they might be stateless, but they might have spent some time in a previous country, or they might have a parent who has citizenship to another country. And that link, either residence or a parent who has citizenship to another country, might suffice for a legal fact finder to say, well, you are technically stateless. We're not going to acknowledge that, but we think that you're a citizen of this country because you potentially could obtain citizenship in that country via your mother, via the fact that you had residence in this place and you, could pursue things at that location. And to me, that's really troubling because, first, as many of us know, the administrative legal process is never a guarantee that once you engage with it through an application process, the outcome is very, we just don't know what a decision maker will decide. And citizenship applications are like that. And my research shows that even though on its face somebody might be entitled to citizenship, they might not actually acquire it, even though they tick all the boxes. The other thing is that there's this weird move that's happening in legal discourse about the fact that people can be seen as citizens of other places and requiring this preliminary due diligence on the part of stateless persons to exhaust all their remedies, so to speak, when, there isn't such a requirement in international law, and I think it's become a legal trend whereby decision makers are requiring this kind of exhaustion. But if you think about it on a practical level, it requires a person to approach 260 odd countries to verify that they can't get citizenship elsewhere. And in cases where even they have tried to obtain confirmation, that still doesn't satisfy the court. And I'm thinking of the very famous case of Abu Lakhdi, where His parents were, the facts in dispute in that case were whether or not his parents were working for the Indian consulate at the time. The court ultimately found that they were, but India, throughout the proceedings, kept saying that they, Budlokhadi was not a citizen of India. And despite that, Canada still deemed him a citizen of India. So I think it's for us as lawyers, I think we should be very concerned about the very thin evidence, if at all. And I would say there's no evidence. It's a more speculative findings about where people should be considered from and what kind of citizenship they have. And I think it's the confirmation through legal documentation that really should stand at the end of the day in certain legal proceedings.
Yeah, this challenge exists whenever the onus is on an applicant to prove a negative, I find. And so the onus of trying to establish that you are not a citizen of a place is, or any other situation, there are numerous other ones though, that I could come up with, are challenging. We've been talking the last episode, we were talking about proving that you are not going to be a spy in the future. This is another one of these things which has become a preoccupation of us. But these proving negatives are very challenging. And I think the other part that that you go into at some length is that the best that an applicant can generally, or a claimant can generally do, is to establish that the process of adjudicating or deciding those citizenship processes, that they're not neutral. Oftentimes it's like, well, it's because the registration is slow. And I really appreciated the remark that you said that like these are sometimes chalked up to administrative matters, that registration of citizens has failed, but that doesn't mean that you're not entitled to that citizenship. And just kind of piercing the veil about the neutrality of that registration process, that often these are not neutral factors, but rather things that are because of systemic bias or racism or whatever the case may be. And so statelessness is not done by way of an accident, that it can be a concerted decision that is actually made for the registration not to occur.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge because for many of us in immigration law, we have confronted the administrative legal system quite aggressively, I would say, right? That is our bread and butter. But I think for a lot of people, they take for granted that they would go to a government counter and expect, certain kinds of service and expect certain forms to be given to them, that they will be treated with respect, that they will. That the information they give will be taken for granted and things will process as expected. But this is not always the case for people who are stateless. And sometimes they are gaslit about who they actually are, where they actually come from, and the potential links that they have. So, family, community, employment, all these things are questioned. And in an administrative context, which is not increasingly, the court's always calling for more deference to the things that are happening there. There's some really troubling things happening in these venues to people who might not be as savvy as legal practitioners. And so you have things in my research where you see people being denied proper forms, being told erroneous information, given bad advice, and sometimes being outright denied based on really extraneous or frivolous reasons. I've also witnessed at the government counters in some of these places where some people were told, okay, you brought your marriage certificate. Now you need to bring another documentation to show, that the marriage occurred at that place and you need verification from that embassy or whatever. So there's always added requirements in different places and things like that. It's very confusing for people who don't have legal counsel or support. It might be a little bit different in Canada, but I think in Canada as well, we've seen, forms get changed all the time. New information is required. I think even just the new special program for Gazans, there's new things in that form that some of us have never seen before. So this happens all the time, and I think as lawyers, we should put the governments on notice that we're watching and we're concerned about the moves that they make and what does it mean what do these moves mean? So yeah, Deanna, I really appreciate your comment about how, you know, my research is really about not just the legal barriers, but what is the meaning behind the requirements, the moves that the administrative process requires. What kinds of things do they say about our society, about who we value as persons, who are we welcoming, and what kinds of things that law is shielding or hiding?
Yeah, and I think it also highlights the disparity between if you're able to afford counsel or not in your ability to get these documents. You can see cases, say, one example that we've seen where the government is alleging that someone from China who's a Canadian citizen would easily be able to obtain Chinese citizenship. And that person is saying, well, no, if you take away my Canadian citizenship, I'll be stateless. And this dispute arises over just how easy is it to get Chinese citizenship? And if you're able to connect with like a lawyer or anyone who can just find someone in China to give a legal opinion, that person will be a huge advantage over someone who doesn't have those resources, which can then lead to just very unfortunate results.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think you're right because, you know, the word of the applicant is no longer given as much weight, you know, in terms of their knowledge of their own administrative hassle of trying to obtain certain kinds of status and things. I also see this in cases where people might not have citizenship as well, or might not have the opportunity to get citizenship, but the fact that they've had temporary status elsewhere is also a factor, and it kind of adds a veneer to their application to say, well, why didn't you pursue long-term, you know, avenues in X country that you were working in temporarily. So, you know, there's this move beyond citizenship that if you even have immigration status elsewhere, could you be deemed, you know, could that be seen as an avenue for you? And it kind of takes away, you know, away from the actual examination of the merits of the case, right? We never get to the question of, are you deserving of refugee protection? Because we're kind of distracted by this notion that you're a foreigner that actually belongs elsewhere, right? And so I think that's quite troubling in many respects, especially as Canada contemplates the kinds of protection we want to offer to people and who we want to do that for.
And there's also just the issue of the barriers that exist from the outset because the person needs to be outside of their country of
Yes.
citizenship in order to make a claim. What does that mean for a person who is stateless? How do they travel when they don't have any identity documents? And so already there are numerous obstacles standing in the way of that person accessing the refugee scheme. In general.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's it makes it curious about the fact that statelessness is a very distinct issue facing people. And I think, you know, some people might think, oh, well, why can't they just obtain refugee protection? Well, if the technical act of being stateless is not a ground for protection under refugee law, right? So a lot of stateless people I know of actually, including my father immigrated to Canada as an economic migrant, you know, and I think, you know, for a lot of stateless people, they don't quite have the, and this might sound really crass as a lawyer, but they don't have the facts to plug into the refugee definition. And so, you know, Canada has really, I think, been lackluster in its approach to providing any kind of resolution to the issue of statelessness. And I think there's this kind of fear of the floodgates, you know, the common problem of like, well, if we address it for a certain group of people, will this be, you know, a floodgate issue? But I think, you know, in my research, as I'm moving through the Canadian context, there are pockets of people. It's very predictable to figure out who's stateless and what kinds of cases come to Canada. I'm thinking, you know, during the time when Jason Kenney was Minister of Immigration, there was a lot of public rhetoric about Koreans and how North Koreans are actually South Koreans. And I look in my research right now about the moves that governments make in terms of conferring ghost citizenship, like conferring South Korean citizenship on people who were not really sure if they will actually get it. And then another group of people, my research is Palestinians, you know, they are often stateless and come to Canada, but sometimes may not qualify for, in the past, they didn't, a lot of them didn't qualify for refugee protection. Another group includes people who kind of are, you know, targeted through inadmissibility and then find themselves stateless after not realizing that they, you know, either as children or through the immigration process, did not complete the step of getting citizenship. And so there's a lot of people that fall through the cracks because our legal categories and criteria simply don't address statelessness very well.
And perhaps also children born as people who are living without status. And I mean, if they're born in a country that confers citizenship based on birth on that soil, but if it is not such a country that they're born into, then the question of their citizenship also is totally ambiguous.
Yeah, and I guess I would say too is that a significant portion of the world's statelessness population are children, right? So, right from the get-go, you know, many people are living with the status, and you know, unless they have a parent or a guardian that is willing to navigate all of the legal loopholes to try to resolve it, they're really, you know, they belong to a very vulnerable population who might suffer from a lot of health and social consequences.
Well, I think you mentioned in your book that a lot, or maybe the largest category of stateless people in Malaysia are just people who can't get the documents to prove that they are Malaysian. Even though under law they likely are, proving it renders them de facto stateless.
Yeah, and I just think about, you know, when I was practicing full time, I remember, you know, tasking clients being like, okay, here's a list of documents I need from you, right? And that's such a daunting activity to just acquire documentation for some people. This is, you know, compounded in statelessness circumstances where you have places who don't keep records. They might not, you know, what if the person was not born in a hospital? The kinds of rules associated with, confirming that your birth occurred in on Malaysian soil requires something as ridiculous as four witnesses. And what if only a midwife was present during your birth, you know? So these kinds of barriers are extra, I would say, outside of just the labor of obtaining documentation, right? Going to the offices, there's fees associated with getting documents, as we all know. And then translating them if they're not in the correct language for the official. All of these steps are seem monumental, especially for people who are of a working class background, if they're working shifts or whatnot and can't get to a registrar or government office during open hours to obtain like proof. All of these things really compound, I think, the experience of why people sometimes simply can't meet, you know, some of the basic requirements, right, that are. And then it's frustrating when you get to a government office and say, that's not enough. Actually, now we also need this. And then they're being told that after they've been given an initial list of things to do. So it's a very disheartening process for some people to go through.
You made clear in your book that that this research project was motivated both by personal and by kind of overarching like legal and political drivers. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about what led you to this piece of work.
Yeah, I'm very lucky in the sense that I have a job that, you know, allows me to research on things that I'm passionate about. And I was lucky enough to have a sabbatical in 2018. And I really wanted to go back to where my parents had come from, and was really fascinated with my father's own personal history of being a stateless person himself. You know, and I always had thought that it was an unusual thing growing up, but then as I was practicing immigration law, I encountered more and more stateless persons and read more about their cases. And I wanted to understand how is it possible that statelessness still exists today. So I went back, and there's a huge advocacy environment in Malaysia of lawyers and advocates on stateless issues there. And I really learned a lot from them, but also was able to, you know, dive deep into having conversations with stateless people about what it felt like to be stateless, what they experienced through the administrative and legal process. And then coming home to Canada and realizing that it's not so different here, that the experience of stateless persons in post-British colonial states are very similar because of the inherited laws that we acquired through the British Empire. And so it's been fascinating to see that statelessness is a product of colonization. You know, as we talk about decolonial approaches to immigration law, I would say this is one area where more attention has to be paid about the roots of citizenship law, how they come from British hierarchical, racialized notions of categorizing people, and how that's really informed our laws. In Malaysia, citizenship laws are embedded in its constitution. In Canada, we have our own Citizenship Act, but the practices, rationales, and purposes behind the citizenship law is very similar. And the ways in which the judiciary is picking up, the approaches of legal findings about what citizenship a person has, as we spoke about earlier, is identical in a lot of different contexts. And so it was fascinating for me to see how this is being reproduced and the roots of it, that it really stems from those nascent times of creating independent countries out of British colonization, but that really just ensconcing like ideas of citizenship through that colonial lens.
This part of the conversation reminds me a fair bit of a conversation that Steve and I had several months ago with another academic, Simon Wallace, where we were talking about the history of deportation law in Canada and how it was sort of at some point Canada sort of conferred on itself this right to not just it sort of created these statutory powers where it said now we have the right to expel those that are not entitled to be here on this. And so he went on the same sort of a historical deep dive about when did this begin? Where were the origins? And again, came up with some of the same conclusions that you did, that it goes back to these very basic notions of sovereignty where, these are things that we take for granted, that they're part of our basic understanding of what nationhood means, that there are some who belong and that exist and are allowed to remain and be at liberty to do what they want. And there are those who are considered outsiders, and that once you set it up in this way, that there are those who fall through the cracks. And so, but it's the same sort of ideology and many of the same roots.
Yeah, I would say a lot of the infrastructure and the ways in which we designed, as you say, sovereign borders and sovereign mechanisms to manage the movement of people and communities, it's really astonishing how the same tools that were used during time when Canada was a colony are being replicated in different ways today and just given different names. We actually haven't been very innovative in the ways. I mean, I guess the point system is innovative, but it's in a sense it's a different replication of the kinds of ways in which we reinforce notions about what we value and who we value and what constitutes someone who's deserving of citizenship, right? And it reinforces notions of the fact that there are people who are always going to be other. And, I guess I would say, the fact that Canada hasn't paid a lot of attention to resolving statelessness is probably in part due to the license that they, in the moves that they make in terms of refugee protection, that they have a very generous refugee resettlement program, that we have a pretty well-established refugee determination system. And this allows us to kind of ignore, other groups of people who might not fit into those acceptable, I guess, ways in which Canada provides safe haven to people.
You want to discuss, you got into your book, like going back to what Simon had said on the previous episode, he talked about how when it came to Canada's first deportation, there was a discussion about would this fall under sovereign prerogative or something done through legislation. And something that then with legislation builds into rights, and how if a different decision had been made, back in when the first deportation at the turn of the 20th century, that it was sovereign privilege and couldn't really be challenged in courts, how different everything would be today. You talk in your book about sovereign privilege versus a rights-based approach, viewing statelessness in this context. You want to go into a bit about that distinction?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. I remember back when Donald Galloway and I were writing our urban law text, and we were like diving deep into that single case that's been, quoted over and over again in immigration law in Canada about how the state has the right to deny anybody access or authorization to enter Canada, and that nobody has a right to enter Canada as and we were perplexed as to where this came from, and it really just came out of thin air. There, it might have come from like an old English case, but it was just an empty pronouncement that really had no legal tie to anything. And if you look at the Magna Carta and other older texts, yes, there was an idea that the sovereign took care of people and within its borders, and they describe people as vessels and chattels and blah, blah, blah. But there was never an idea that the sovereign could outright deny people entry within a territory, and that it was seen as, movement of people seen as a necessary conduit of society and the economy. And so this notion that the state has that prerogative to say no at its will for any reason whatsoever is kind of a make-believe power, and so I think, the struggle I had in that book was that, A, there's this very strong prerogative state power that has been replicated over and over and over again in jurisprudence and in the interpretation of our immigration laws. And, the ways that lawyers have tried to confront this is by through a rights regime. And yet, my argument there is that human rights always fall short because the right of the state is always going to trump that. And the state's always pushed back on the notion that, yes, there are human rights, and yes, to some extent, we're going to look at that person's individual rights. But ultimately, what is given more weight is this sovereign prerogative that we can say yes or no on any reason whatsoever. And I mean any reason, because the state is unabashedly about discretion, has said, authorization to enter Canada is ultimately at the discretion and at the whim of the state. And so it's a very powerful power that has been unquestioned for a lot for many Canadians and taken for granted, and all often picked up in public discourse to say, people are coming in illegally. This gives license to this notion of how people are moving and making them illegal. When if you trace those kinds of notions in law, it has become so, quote unquote, illegal only by, a single pronouncement made by one judge a very, very, very long time ago, which is kind of, maybe that's the way law is made in our common law system, but I think we should question it more in terms of, what kind of society do we want to live in, and why do we give so much power to the sovereign, with very little accountability in this regard, and the ways in which the immigration legal community have been pushing back have been, it's a struggle, and if you look at charter litigation and whatnot, the sovereign prerogative always seems to infiltrate, if not outwardly, it certainly permeates the thinking. I think Justice Roe said in like a couple of decisions in the last couple of years that, reiterating that notion that there is no right to enter Canada, right? And I think, that says a lot about, I think we should interrogate the roots of that a little bit more, and similar to what your previous podcast interviewees have interrogated, where is this coming from, and how and why we have reproduced this in the various ways we have.
Yeah, it's very like I've been doing research on the origins of the Chinese head tax and why that was originally brought in instead of, because one of the questions I was asking was, well, why a tax instead of just banning them? And back in the 1880s, that just wasn't viewed as a thing, right? Like it was, oh, well, we can't ban people from entering. Anybody would have the ability to enter Canada, but we can tax. And the even notion of outright just this person can or cannot enter the country. There was
And yet
brief
then
discussion on it because British Columbia was lobbying for it, but at the federal government, they were like, but that's not how we control borders, and that's not how borders work.
that's
But then
fascinating.
subsequently,
there was apologies around the discriminatory nature of the head tax, and yet we recoiled in the other direction, and there seems at this moment to be no real shame associated with saying, no, we can just prohibit. This is precisely why we wanted to have you on the program, is because this is, I think, something that there's been a lot of tension around and a lot of people doing inquiry, but to bring some life to an intelligent, academic, informed conversation about, I know this is how it is. I know this is how we've all accepted it to be, but can we look at this again one more time and be like, and it's not just that this is how we have established that this is the authority, but we have actually made it virtually impossible for those borders to be penetrated. It's all about fortifications and about making it impossible for our refugee claimants to even approach our borders and setting quotas and, the supposed generosity of our refugee system and all of this sort of thing, where it's, this is all built on this notion of statehood that I don't think is being fundamentally questioned at a deep level. It's just about putting into place these mechanisms that make the goal of arrival virtually out of reach, and then just going through the motions of enforcing and further entrenching these systems that exist here, without going back to a first principles conversation about, okay, this went in there at this time. It wasn't there before. It's there now. Are we all okay with this? And I just really like how your book breathes life into that at a very like engaged but professional academic level. It's sort of, I've been saying on the last few shows that I feel like I'm going through all of the practice of law with this very childlike attitude going, but why? But why? And just feeling like it feels very naive, but at the same time, when you come at it from the perspective of a research academic perspective and say, well, it wasn't always like this. This is something that at some point we decided on and we've now all settled. And are we okay with the consequences?
Yeah, and ultimately, I think a lot of people try to view the law as appearing to be neutral, but ultimately, as you said earlier, we really can't assume that they are neutral and that they're applying equally to everyone, and certainly I think what's been interesting is that recent litigation that's been going through the courts in Canada, we see this kind of defense of that, right? Of that state prerogative. And this is this kind of heavy hammer on the ways in which different decisions the government has made is justified under that. But Stephen, I'd love to hear more about what you found in terms of like the justification for that mode. Because I think, even though it wasn't an outright ban, it did effectively act like one, right? And in some ways. And it's being replicated in different ways with quotas, and it's
Yeah, I
just
mean,
interesting seeing.
it wasn't very effective, which is why they eventually did just switch to an outright ban. Then I can do a whole separate. I mean, eventually I plan on doing like a whole episode on the Chinese head tax, and the how it led from building a railroad to head tax to ban. But it is just like it's watching, and it's part of why I find history fascinating is like seeing how we get to where we are, and also how complex like the unintended consequences of complicated legislation, which is another thing that Yana and I have been discussing on several episodes lately, how you don't hear the politicians kind of opining on what they think of the consequences of some of their actions. So going to you mentioned the Budlokti decision earlier about the person who couldn't be a citizen of Canada because he may have had a claim to Indian citizenship that the courts ruled he hadn't fully exhausted. At the time that that decision came down, the Harper government was trying to introduce its bills that would strip citizenship of what they call dual citizens who were
Mm-hmm.
convicted of certain serious offenses. And in the media, it was always portrayed as dual citizens. The politicians always referred to it as dual citizens, which created this impression of like, well, they're people who choose to be citizens of two countries, like, tough on them for having chose that. Whereas the actual legislation was people who wouldn't be rendered stateless. And I
Yes.
remember Robin Seligman was on the podcast a few episodes. She was arguing before a committee, I think the Senate committee, that a consequence of that could be, well, what about all Jews in Canada who arguably, at first glance, someone who didn't know the ins and outs of Israeli citizenship law could say, well, they could always become citizens in Israel. And I
Right.
remember her making that argument. It's not, it's it in the context of how certain other laws are developing, it wouldn't be that unforeseeable that a bureaucrat would make the determination. The court would say, well, based on the evidence before the officer, it's reasonable for the officer to have concluded that this person could have been Israeli, and then the law just takes off
It
in a
definitely could happen.
direction.
That's an excellent example. I think it definitely could happen. That and there, I mean, they could, there's a lot of case law they could pull on for examples and say it's been done before. We find we can make this legal finding this person's actually eligible for Israeli citizenship, and therefore we can go ahead and strip their citizenship here. Like
And then
I can
ultimately, for
actually
those
see
who
it.
don't know, the law was, I think, I don't remember if it was struck down in court. I think the Liberals just amended the act to get rid of it. But
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, but it's frightening that that even was tabled in public discussion or in even in parliamentary discussion, right? That it really thins the idea of citizenship. And it's frightening because citizenship is really opens the door to a lot of things that people need in their lives, like basic necessities.
The other one recently was the striking down of the restriction on citizenship of dissent. It's
Yes.
interesting, like in that one, as Canadians start, I was always wondering, like, if IRCC treated Canadian citizens, if Canadian citizens got to experience what it's like to be an immigrant struggling to get documents, would they like, take to the streets? And during COVID, there were the passport delays, which
Yes.
like verbally seemed to rise to this level of national crisis, but it's, I don't know. I thought we actually like, I was surprised that people did put up with it. So I'm not
Yeah.
as convinced that as I used to be, that if Canadians would only experience it, they'd rise up.
Well, I did find it interesting during COVID when people were separated from their families because of the border closures, and they were, up in arms about being separated from their families. And I was like, this is not new. Like they acted like this was a new thing that was happening in Canada. And oh my gosh, like what is Canada? Why is the state interfering with my, reunification with my family? And I'm like, it's always done that. It's just never applied to you. Right? So it's really interesting. Yeah.
And the number of situations in which people just have no ability to obtain the documents that they require. Like we're not just talking about situations of inconvenience, but there is like an actual barrier to being able to obtain proof of citizenship in the country of citizenship, or where there's actually danger associated with trying to obtain recognition of citizenship because of ethnicity or some other factor. These issues are quite routine in the refugee sector. And so I think they can sometimes when you speak of them as just entitlement to citizenship, to talk about those as dry facts as if they're neutral, does become extremely problematic.
For sure. And I think it's interesting because statelessness, I think, is a issue that should be watched because as we kind of watch around the world where stateless populations are growing, they're kind of the canary in the coal mine. So I'm thinking about the Rohingya in Burma, and how, that is an example where statelessness, the stripping of citizenship, is used as a tool of oppression. I'm thinking about in Assam, India, where millions of Muslim have been stripped of citizenship, there again a kind of move against a certain ethnic religious group, and a sign that of troubling oppression that's happening in that part of the world. So I think, where we see issues of statelessness arising, like we as immigration lawyers can see the tide coming when people claiming refugee protection. But, Canada, I think, should be taking a more active role in monitoring these situations and then acting as we have in the past as international spokesperson or around these issues. And I think Canada's been very absent on that, which has been disappointing for me as a scholar that's watching this issue unfold before our eyes.
Yeah, it feels like it's well, there's just been a few global conflicts that have totally preoccupied the. I don't even know. Do we have a pro? Has there been a program for the Rohingya in
I
Canada? I
don't
don't think
think
so.
so. No, but I do. I have seen a couple of cases from other people, not myself, come through where they have been able to get refugee protection. But again, it's like if they get here kind of thing, right? And I mean, it is, in both those cases, I imagine there might be security concerns because they are, some of them might be Muslim and things like that. So I'm not sure in terms of what kinds of processes people have been navigating as a result of that,
I
Well,
think
this
that
year, I
we
think we're
did
supposed
have
to
a
take
response.
5,000 Uyghurs this year. They announced,
That's
or the House voted on it last year, 2 years ago. I have no idea if anything's coming from it.
that would be interesting to see. Yeah. And I think that's an important program for sure. Those kinds of nods to the fact that these people are being oppressed makes a huge political statement, right?
The other area where you see statelessness a fair bit is all along the Ukraine, Estonia, Latvia, in terms of how their Russian population, a lot of them are like de facto stateless. And now coming the other way is Russia, Ukrainians who came here and are from, say, the Donbass or something, how that's all, and which is now under Russian control, how that will all be navigated.
Some of them have been forced to take Russian citizenship, which is
And then they
problematic
lose their
too.
Ukrainian citizenship, I think. I saw Estonia for people who were forced to take Russian.
Which is also, I think, that isn't, something I've been toying with the idea of going researching later on is just this idea of forced citizenship, because in law this is happening in many cases. It's like you're actually Indian citizen, but in Russia, like they're actually forcing people to be deemed as Russian citizens, and it actually has significant consequences for them, right?
If you want your research to take a complete turn, you can go interview some sovereign citizens who would say that they've been forced to take Canadian citizenship and they
Yes,
don't.
that too.
Right? That's a
That
whole
too.
other.
Yeah, well, there's, indigenous communities that have their own passport system, and I think an intriguing idea too, because it is kind of a move against the state in the way that in which they've been managing and the movement of people and ideas about, who are legitimate communities within our borders, right? So
Oh, that's a whole. I think there was a Supreme Court decision today
today.
on child care, the
Oh, it's the
delivery
child
of child
welfare.
welfare in which Quebec had challenged, which is a similar like whose jur I mean it's we're getting a bit off topic, but whose citizen whose jurisdiction do you fall under?
Yeah, but it did give, that seemed like a very positive decision for the Indigenous community involved. So,
yeah, I haven't seen that one yet, but definitely this issue of citizenship in our own borders is still extremely complicated when it comes to Indigenous communities, because still the recognition for right to entry in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act is still tied to registration in the Indian Act. And the thing that's, because Canada doesn't recognize the Jay Treaty as being a document that Canada is a party to. And so, I mean, this is something that Canada has said it's going to take under study and consider, and is doing a further round of consultations now. But even within our own domain, it's something that the question of, right of entry and access and what Indigenous communities can do, when they cross the 49th parallel, what rights follow with them. That still is completely unresolved. Even when they have been conferred when there's been recognition of, like, let's say Nishka citizenship and Nishka passports were issued, that then people started to encounter problems coming across the Canada border with those passports. So this is an entirely different episode as well. But I think that the idea that these problems are only occurring elsewhere, I think in fact, these issues, these deep seminal issues about sovereignty and what does it mean and where are the limits, they have a lot of relevance, and they need to be ascertained in a more thorough way, even just in our own borders.
Yeah, and I kind of invite people to think about it using Indigenous legal traditions too. Like closer to the end of my book, I don't provide any answers about how to resolve this, but I think there's something to be said about the ideas of relationality, respect, and in Indigenous legal traditions that can be informed through especially administrative legal encounters, right, and decision making. And having more compassion and realizing this person is part of the community, and how do we want to interact with them in a respectful and compassionate way, right? And so I kind of, very lightly invite people to think about that and to use, a pluralistic legal lens to see what other communities view as a proper way to engage with visitors, and especially those that are seeking help. But the other thing is, I've kind of pressed on the notion that people are visitors, that some of these people have been deemed visitors, but they're really not. They're actually people within our community have long-standing links. And how do we want to, welcome them back into the fold in a, in a way that is principled and true to the tenets of what we try to aspire to in our laws, right? And some of these people have always said, I am a citizen. And one of the most beautiful things that I've discovered in my research is how stateless people, the ones that I interacted with at least, were very resilient, but also steadfast in their identity, in saying, I am a citizen. I don't want to apply through naturalization like the government counter is telling me to do. I want to be declared a citizen because it is important for me to be recognized as from this community, as of this community, and that I only have this one legal hurdle to overcome in terms of actually having identification, right? So those kinds of things, kind of pushing back on assumptions that people are foreign, that people don't already are part of our community, and also these notions of how do we want our legal system to operate in a principled manner with integrity, right? So,
No, I think that's a great point to end on.
for sure. I think you said it beautifully.
Thank you, and thank you for engaging with my research. It's it's rewarding enough to engage with something you're passionate about, but to have people to converse with is a gift.
Yeah, you've done really valuable work here, and I thank you for the effort and for coming and talking to us about what you're working on.